Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
On Breadbox Media, this is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight about the history of our glorious Catholic Church. And on this podcast, I'm discussing the Muslim occupation of the peninsula that is now France, Spain, and Portugal. It lasted for over 700 years, until finally Ferdinand Isabella expelled Muslims from the area that is now Gibraltar in 1492, as a matter of fact. And now Isabella could turn her attention to funding Christopher Columbus's voyage to find a new route, a new, more profitable route, to the Far East. In order to support freeing the Holy Land itself, the purpose of Columbus' voyage was evangelical. It's important to read what he wrote about how he cherished the American Indians. He valued these Aboriginal people and wanted to save their souls for Christ. I've done a podcast in which I read his own words. Perhaps people today need to listen to that, to have an accurate view of this devout Catholic man, Cristoforo Colombo. But our subject today is about women and what was their status in Islamic Spain, in an area often referred to by modern scholars as Al-Andalusia. That term is a modern invention. But people of the time didn't call it that. They called it Spain. How were the women treated there? Well, the men were treated very poorly too. But the more attractive women were kept as slaves, harem slaves. Attractive, fair-skinned women. There was a small Jewish population who was treated somewhat better and used as an ally to monitor the Catholic population. But this podcast addresses the treatment of women and the influence they had on Muslim culture. So often, that culture is traceable to the influence of these educated women. So let's talk about that.
Now, the impact of these Caucasian Catholic women on the Muslim rulers of the Middle East was amazingly significant. As some historians have noted, the mothers of most Abbasid caliphs were Caucasian sexual slaves, often of Greek, Balkan, or Persian origin. In Egypt, slaves of Turkish, Mongol, Caucasian, Circassians, Georgians, Greeks, Frankish, and other origins constituted a dynasty, the Mamluks, that lasted for several generations. With the eventual takeover of the Mamluk leadership by the Circassians, the word Mamluk, which means owned in Arabic, came to designate any white male slave. In the Ottoman Empire, the most decisive and influential branch of the army, the Janissaries, the very famous Janissaries, was made up of European Catholic children, young boys, usually taken at about 10 years of age, from coastal towns along France and the Mediterranean coast. They were taken from Catholic Greek and Balkan lands and brought up as fearless Muslim warriors. The massive trade in captured or bought black and white slaves was a cultural feature of Islamic Spain, as it was of the Muslim world in general. The Arab trade in African black slaves reached vast proportions with the growth of the Islamic Empire and led to several revolts. The Persian Al-Tabari historian dedicates one of his treatises to one of these black slave revolts. It happened about the year 869. Hundreds of thousands of Bantu slaves went on a rampage through southern Iraq, and their rioting was put down with great difficulty by the army of the Caliph. Muslim paintings in the Topkapi Museum depict Muhammad, and of course his face is left blank to comply with Muslim law. They depict Muhammad with black slaves. In fact, Islamic warriors pioneered the slavery of African blacks. It began with Islamic warriors. Now, the Quran does not proclaim the superiority of any racial group. Both Muslim Arabs and Muslim North African Berbers consider themselves different from and superior to blacks, whom they enslaved. In Islamic lands, the trade in black slaves from Africa, and sometimes of predominantly young men, and sometimes of predominantly young females, was immense. One great military leader was able to give to each one of his victorious Muslim warriors both a black male and a black female slave. The most famous literary work produced by the Islamic Caliphate is one that you probably know about, the 1001 Nights, also known as the Arabian Nights. It's not generally known, but most of the tales are originally Persian, Indian, and even Greek origin. A theme running through the Arabian Nights is a cultural fear of the black male. The charming narrative that frames the tale centers on the discovery by two rulers that their wives are having sex with black slaves. Both black slaves are described in very unflattering terms, one of them depicted climbing down a tree to have sex with a queen. The younger ruler slays his wife and her black lover. His elder brother, a sultan, kills his wife, her black lover, and as if that was not enough, everyone else in his harem. He decides to punish women in general. So he has sex every night with a different young virgin taken from the helpless population. After this night of love, he orders the girl beheaded in the morning. Well, this goes on for 3 years until he has depleted almost all of the virgin population of his realm. Then one of the hundreds of virgins he has sex with, the elder daughter of his vizier, his minister, charms him with her tales and wit, is pardoned, and all ends well. I think you know her name. It's Scheherazade. Yes, there was immense trade in black slaves, but the trade in white slave was not far behind. Starting in the 1530s into the 1780s, it is estimated that in Islamic lands between 1 million and 1 1/4 million white slaves were traded, taken from the Mediterranean coasts, Greeks, the Balkans, Armenia, Persia, and Slavic lands, among other places. There's a 10th century geographer, Ibn Hawqal. He observed that one of the main exports of Al-Andalus was slaves. He wrote this: a well-known article of exportation consists of slaves, boys and girls taken from France and Gaul, as well as slave eunuchs. All the slave eunuchs that one finds in the face of the earth come from Spain. One forces them to undergo castration in this country. The surgery is done by Jewish merchants. There was a class of older slave women that was part of the slave trade, participating as trainers, buyers, and sellers of the sexual slave women. These women were celebrated in the writings of wide-eyed Western scholars, seemingly unaware of the rather sordid reality behind this much-admired literature that was thought to be about love. Well, nothing remotely comparable in quantity, quality, to these phenomenal happenings of human slavery occurred within Catholic Europe in medieval times. There were some slaves in Catholic Europe as well, but nothing close to their number in the Islamic lands. And scholars sometimes attempt to use medieval serfdom as an equivalent to slavery in the Muslim world. And that just doesn't work at several levels, including the serfs' limited role in the armies and in the noble and warrior classes of Europe. Moreover, serfs who were peasants could not be bought or sold. To emphasize the point, in a place like Castile, there were no serfs at all. There was a middle class. In Castile, in medieval times, it was basically a land of free property-owning peasants and hidalgos in search of adventure in the wild southern frontier. And it goes without saying that harems, full of sexual slaves guarded by slaves, eunuchs, is not part of the social fabric of Catholic Spain or Europe. But what about their intellectual skills that they're rather famous for? In the 11th century, for example, one ruler had 150 slave girls trained in singing and dancing, but a number of them became famous as well for their scientific and literary knowledge. A properly trained female sexual slave in an Andalusian ruler's court could have more operational room than the musan, the Muslim wife, especially if the court was particularly artistic or intellectual. In addition, a lower class and lower income Muslim woman would by necessity do some kind of work outside the house, such as spinning or knitting, or as a saleswoman of the local market, all of which would give her an opportunity to widen her sphere of activity. But none of these women would be a pauper Mushan, the high-class wife, Muslim wife, who would willingly segregate herself into her home and veil herself in front of anyone not her husband. So there were market regulations. An interesting thing is the market regulations in 12th century Seville. It gives a real picture of the condition of women in general. These regulations would not apply to the high-class Muslim. They would be made to stay home. I'll quote from a few of these regulations. Women should not sit by the river in the summer if men should appear there. No barber may remain alone with a woman in his booth. He should work in the open market in a place where he can be seen and observed. Each person should keep to his own trade and not claim any skill of which he is not an acknowledged master, especially with women, since ignorance and error are greater among women. Only good and trustworthy men, known as such among people, may be allowed to have dealings with women in buying and selling. The women who weave brocades must be banned from the market, for they are nothing but harlots. On festival days, men and women shall not walk in the same path when they go to cross the river. The contractor at the bathhouse should not sit there with the women, for this is the occasion for license and fornication. The contractor of prostitutes, which were always slave girls, must be forbidden to stay and bareheaded outside the houses. They must be stopped from party-making among themselves, even if they have been permitted to do this by their masters. Dancing girls must be forbidden to bare their heads. The not unlikely violations of Islamic mores by an indeterminate number of Muslim wives, Mushana, in Islamic Spain, would be more frequent during regimes of weak religious zeal, and therefore weak political control. So this picture that wishful Western academics write is a fantasy at best, and a shoddy professional reading of the historical evidence at worst. What picture? Well, the vision of scores of bejeweled free Muslim women walking about in Anandalus with long flowing hair and elegant silk dresses while freely enjoying life in public places and working as poets, lecturers, teachers, librarians, and so forth. Under that tolerant and enraptured eyes of Muslim men, it's all of academic fantasy. So the differences between Muslim women in Islamic Spain and Catholic women in Catholic Spain and their respective access to the public arena can be noticed at the higher levels of authority as well as at the lower levels of everyday life. There's an interesting contrast in the position in politics or in ruling. If one starts at the top, no Muslim woman in Al-Andalus ever became or could become a female emir or a female caliph. Historians have pored over the records trying to find any suggestion of this. What they unearthed was only mothers, wives, or sexual slaves who had variously influenced the behavior of important men. Worse than that, Muslim historians blame the influence of women for the decline of the dynasties. In great contrast, as historian Henry Kamen points out, Catholic Spain was one of the areas in Europe where the political and property rights of women were the most guaranteed to give them a political role. There was absolutely no prejudice against female rulers, nor against female succession to noble titles. And it was quite a contrast to the way women are treated in the Catholic world, where they have reverence and status, and often equal political power. In great contrast, as historian Henry Kamen points out, Catholic Spain was one of the areas in Europe where the political and property rights of women were the most guaranteed to give them a political role. There was absolutely no prejudice against female rulers, nor against female succession to noble titles. In a reversal of the situation in Islamic Spain, in the Catholic kingdoms, women at the higher levels of society could enjoy greater power in the public arena, given the right conditions. Even earlier, in Visigoth Spain, what we know of the Visigoth queens indicates their considerable dynamism and relevance. Some Spanish Catholic queens became sole rulers of their land, even when not ruling alone but in conjunction with a husband, and probably more than in other Western European countries. Spanish Catholic queens functioned with the king in a complementary dynamic. It was fundamentally a contractual arrangement. The best known of all these pairings is, of course, Ferdinand and Isabella. Well, Isabella is the best known of all female Catholic rulers. She was called the Catholic, La Católica, the Queen of Castile and León. The Spanish had a saying, and here's how they put it, as much matters as much, Isabella, as does Ferdinand. There were others before Isabella. Toda Aznarez ruled Navarra with her husband, Sancho García del Grande, and after his death governed jointly with her son, plotted made and unmade alliances. And it is said she traveled to Cordoba to talk to Alraman III. Mayor Sanchez, last Countess of Castile, survived the ambush that killed her husband. His wife ordered the avenging of his death and built a number of public works, and fought against many enemies, took armies to war in person, and reputedly had numerous lovers, and is remembered as a strong, if not a widely beloved queen. Queen Petronila of Aragon ruled with her husband until his death, when she abdicated in favor of her son. We've come up to the year 1173 now. The list of these goes on and on. What about women on the lower social level? Well, the records we have of reconquered frontier towns in the Catholic kingdoms indicate a very similar freedom of action. These Catholic women's access to and power in the public spheres is not replicated or even approximated by free married Muslim women in any Muslim town during the Middle Ages. Such Catholic women, many of them were from Castile, profited from the greater freedom accorded to both men and women by the unique judicial system of this Catholic kingdom, a system that grew out of and reflected a population made up largely of fiercely independent and self-reliant peasants, soldiers, and hidalgos in the perpetual combat readiness of a frontier territory. This legal system of Castile may find its only analogy and only comparable analogy as an achievement in Europe in the development of English common law. For instance, if a woman, a Catholic woman of the aristocracy who inherited the lordship of a town, she'd be royally appointed Signora de Villa, mistress of the town. Such a woman would be an absentee ruler who could name her local bureaucrats and military officers to administer the town and collect revenues. Now, if a Catholic woman owned property, and many, many did, she participated in the politics of the local assemblies because it was based on property ownership. These women voiced their opinions in weekly meetings of the Assembly of Property Owners. A few 10th and 11th century notices of women who took an active part in defending their privileges of their communities against outsiders have survived. Now, married Catholic women worked at all sorts of town businesses, such as bakeries where the wife of the baker was supposed to deal with the female customers. Ovens and bakeries like a river or spring were daily destinations for all sorts of women in town. But dependable property owners' wives and daughters were frequently the only informants the court would heed about the deceptive sales practices, pushing and shoving, or any other kind of disturbance. So this is all very interesting, that women had this elevated status, largely due to the Catholic ethos. Women, if they're married, could work as tavernas at their husband's taverna, although the occupation of barmaid was regarded as lower than that of a woman working at a bakery. They could work as shopkeepers, as marketplace sellers of various kinds of goods. And if they wanted to, they could work in the fields. They managed their own properties, supervised raising of crops and flocks outside the walls of the city. Some village women were rural tenants of town dwellers from whom they evidently did routine farm chores. Paid agricultural labor, however, was commonplace in towns, and a salaried plowman, whose services were those of a farm manager for grain crops, was assisted at harvest by his wife and another woman, whom he hired for the gleaning. Women could own farmland and work as cowherds, as well as farmers. Now, the women did participate in the livestock industry more than as owners than as caretakers of animals, at least of the large commercially valuable flocks and herds, which pastured primarily on the town's common and the mountainsides. They're Catholic cowgirls. There's the lyrics of a famous song by a great poet of the Spanish Middle Ages. This sort of life was inconceivable for a Muslim wife, a high-placed Muslim wife, because her higher level of modesty in everyday life. Catholic women could be present at their parish church after Saturday Vespers or Sunday Mass, and could witness the arrangement of a neighborhood's announcements of land for sale, notification of changes, and other matters of local importance that required publicity. What about legal testimony? Well, under the Muslims, their testimony was legally half that of man, had half the weight as the testimony of man. In Catholic Spain, the woman's testimony was equal. Sometimes a woman's testimony was preferred in matters that required feminine competence, perhaps bakeries, spinning, and other such places and occupations. Finally, it should be remembered that in the convents of Catholic lands, many women, such as the Greek Saint Cassia, the German Hildegard von Bingen, and the Spanish Saint Teresa of Avila, attained high levels of creativity. In music, Catholic Spain had no known equivalent of the Greek nun Cassia or the German nun Hildegard von Bingen, great medieval composers. We know, however, that in Spain, women abbesses like Hildegard in Germany or Cassia in Spain were elected by the community of nuns, new canon law, and function as today's CEOs, as executives in charge of their operations of congregations of nuns. Abbesses of the larger medieval abbeys in Spain, as well as in other lands in Christian Europe, were women of distinction, having as much power and influence within and without the church as the abbots did. Some of these women even appeared at medieval church councils and voted. One interesting fact of this, to historians who have read a great deal of the literature and documents from this time's original sources, is that females with supreme political authority did not seem to their Catholic contemporaries to be anything extraordinary at all. Maria of Castile, Queen of the Crown of Aragon, governed Catalonia as an official for over 2 decades. And later, with her husband Alfonso V, King of the Crown of Aragon, she conquered and governed the Kingdom of Naples. Her career may seem anomalous to us, but she was in fact. But in fact, she was unexceptional. She was ordinary. Many of her contemporaries did the same kinds of things. Monarchy was a collaborative function between the king and queen. And Alfonso X had a legal code, Las Siete Partidas, and other Castilian treaties. The political role of the female monarchs in Christian Spain, as we have seen, already had a precedent above Visigoth queens. The historical example of a greater public role for women in Catholic Spain might, to some people, be traceable to Visigoth culture and law, but a greater influence is the public importance of women and medieval Catholicism, not only in the Catholic West with its numerous queens, but in the lands of the Greek and Russian Catholics, with their many empresses and tsarinas. So we can see that the common view of the treatment of women in the Iberian Peninsula during the period 7 centuries of Muslim domination has not been presented to us accurately. Of course, this wasn't a woman alone. It was men too, Catholic or Jew. These were third and fourth class citizens. They were called, quote, the people of submission, the dhimmis, who had little rights, certainly could not go to court against a Muslim. These Catholics were living under Sharia law. These Jews were living under Sharia law. That was preeminent over their own laws.
Yet we have professors like Hugh Kennedy of the History Department and Languages of Culture in the Near Middle East at the University of London, who wrote in 1996, under the normal course of events, Christian practices under the Umayyads were allowed a wide degree of tolerance. Public and ostentatious displays of faith, like processions and ringings of bells, were discouraged, at least to the capital. But neither the churches nor monasteries were directly threatened. We'll see that that's not so as we go on in this program.
We could go on and on quoting from academics all around the world in the most prestigious institution, telling the story of a tolerant Islam in their treatment of Jews and Christians during those 7 centuries. They're repeating and copying each other. The primary sources show that that's not so, especially the most reputable Spanish histories tell the real story based on primary documents. We have a very false impression about what went on in those days here in the English-speaking world because of the Black Legend, the promotion of the Black Legend by the British Empire for centuries, and it goes on today. Unconsciously accepted a false version of what really went on. The Black Legend is specifically motivated by anti-Catholicism and spurred on by the political rivalry that exists between the British Empire and the Spanish Empire for centuries. The falseness of the Black Legend and the myth that is the subject of this program.
The myth of the Andalusian Paradise is well documented in the book The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise by Dario Fernandez Moreras. He shows again and again that whether it's cultural prejudice or whatever, maybe an anti-Catholic sentiment, these well-researched and indeed very solid histories are ignored. And perhaps we'd use the word suppressed. If you're a bit skeptical, I'm going to give you two more quotes. There are many more from academics from some of our greatest institutions that are totally in the thrall of this false black legend, about which the record needs to be set straight by somebody. Okay, let's take up our second quote. It's by Jane I. Smith,
Associate Dean for Faculty in Academic Affairs at Harvard Divinity School, wrote the entry Islam and Christendom in the Oxford History of Islam, and said this: under Abd el-Rahman III, Muslim tolerance of the so-called people of the book was high, and social intercourse at the upper levels was easy and constant.
Unquote. So the esteemed Jane S. Smith presents another quote that is straight out of the black legend.
Then we have this from Maria Rosa Mendocal, who is Rose Professor of Spanish and Portuguese and Director of Special Programs in the Humanities at Yale University. The ornament of the world, she wrote, how Muslim Jews and Christians created a culture of tolerance in medieval Spain.
Published by Little Brown in New York in 2002.
She wrote this: once upon a time in the mid-8th century, an intrepid young man named Abd el-Rahman abandoned his home in Damascus in their eastern heartland of Islam and set out across the North African desert in search of a place of refuge. This was a chapter in Europe's culture when Jews, Christians, and Muslims lived side by side, and despite their intractable differences and enduring hostilities, nourished a complex culture of tolerance. The new Islamic polity not only allowed Jews and Christians to survive, but following Quranic mandate, by and large, protected them.
Well, if castration of young males to make eunuchs and kidnapping them at 10 years old to become Janissary guards, creating female sexual slaves out of the women, is protecting them, I guess, then the record doesn't need to be set straight. But perhaps it obviously does. During those 7 centuries, the Muslims who ruled the Iberian Peninsula had many names for those Catholics, those Hispano-Visigoths, who after the Islamic conquest remained as Catholics subject to Islam, subject to Islamic hegemony, rather than fleeing to the north. Some of the names were Nazarenes, Rumis, meaning the Romans, Al-Harama, Alhamra, reddish ones because of their white and rosy skin, Mushriks, Polytheists, Elches, Infidels, Kafirs, Infidels, Isawis, followers of Jesus, Ajmis, Barbarians, Cutius, Goths, Adu, enemies of God, and so on. Muahid, one under a subjugation agreement. But the more general term is well known. But it's interesting that no matter how well educated my British friends are, they've generally never even heard the term Dhimmi, meaning they don't know one of the most important aspects of Islam, Dhimmitude. Actually, Dhimmi means beneficiaries of the contract of protection, an insulting name used in popular speech. But the more common name you would hear on the streets for Catholics was pig, Khanzir. Caliphs would call King Alfonso VI of Castile a pig. It's well recorded. A great Arab scholar, well known in Andalusius, mentions humorously the word pigs as applied to Catholics. One name the Muslims of Andalus did not use for Catholics was Mozarabs, nor did Catholics from the north call the Catholic Dhimmis in the south Mozarabs. As the historian Miguel Quesada has pointed out, they call them Spaniards, Spani.
We hear this term Mozarab, but it's a bit of a cover-up. It didn't exist until after 850, when Catholic Dhimmis began to escape, or migrate, as some Islamic studies scholars tactfully prefer, began to escape from their presumably good life under the Umayyads.
and to make their way north into the Catholic kingdoms. These former dhimmis had kept rich and ancient Catholic practices and rituals that predated the Muslim conquest. To the Catholics of the north, these former dhimmis sounded and looked strange. The refugees spoke an archaic Romance dialect that had not changed much since 711 AD. In addition, they knew Arabic, and many had Arabic-sounding names. They showed other signs of having lived subject to Muslim rule for generations. Northern Catholics, perhaps following the lead of these former dhimmis themselves, began to call them Mutsarabis or Mozarabis, all probably derived from the Arabic. Eventually, scholars even adopted the word Mozarab to designate not only the Catholic dhimmis who fled to the north, but also the Catholic dhimmis who remained under Islamic rule. Despite the name Mozarabs, they weren't Arabs in any shape or form. They had, in fact, tried to keep their religion, language, and customs, in other words, their culture, for several centuries under exceedingly difficult political, social, and religious circumstances. Inevitably, however, the dhimmis yielded to the culture, the Islamic culture, and adopted the language from the dominant Muslims. Of course, many Catholics did convert. The pressure to do so was great. How great was this exodus? It was great. By the end of the 12th century, as a result of this flight to Catholic lands, expulsions to North Africa, executions and conversions, the Catholic dhimmi population had largely disappeared from Al-Andalus. When Catholics entered Granada in 1492, led by the great conqueror El-Cid under the direction of Ferdinand Isabella, how many Catholics did they find in the city? How many Catholic dhimmis were in Granada? Zero. There weren't any. That's how great the persecution and flight had been. However, the Catholic culture did influence the dominant Muslim culture, and the culture of the Catholic dhimmis who fled to northern Spain, the Mozarabs, shaped the culture of northern Spain's Catholic kingdoms. Muslims in medieval Spain considered Islam the final and most perfect form of divine revelation. They also believed that Christians and Jews, who they called the people of the book, had strayed from the teachings of their Bible in various ways that rendered them inferior, religiously inferior, to Muslims who had kept the true faith. Given this conviction of superiority, Islam in medieval Spain could hardly be said to be tolerant of other religions. To prevent other faiths from contesting the religious and therefore political, social, and cultural supremacy of Islam, rulers and clerics endeavored to keep every type of hegemony over these people of the book. A thing that is not to be missed when we consider that Islam is a religion, it is really a political system, an entire cultural system. It's a theocracy. It's a political system that contains religion. They are not separate. It's all the same thing. Don't be confused by the phrase political system and the word religion as being two separate things. And under Islam, they were not. Under Catholics, they were. There were secular kings, and there was the Pope and the bishops and the priests, interacting, but separate. Now, it is true that Catholics assumed the position of authority, varying authority, even while remaining outsiders. The Muslim regime sometimes enlisted skilled Catholics to serve as bureaucrats or soldiers. For the same reason it enlisted Jewish functionaries. They would be loyal to the Muslim ruler and to nobody else. Why? Because they had no allegiance to any rival of the Muslim leader, any Muslim rival. So any potential rival did not have allegiance of these people any more than the man they served under. And if you had a ruler who lacked strong religious convictions, who might also turn into be a Catholic for whom he had personal sympathy, that might be another reason they might serve him. This success his office presented as evidence that Catholic life under Islam was favorable, this successful conversion. But as was the case with the Jews who assumed position of authorities under Muslim rulers, such conversion or success involved only elites. It did not extend to the masses. Moreover, it occurred in spite of and in direct opposition to Islamic injunctions, and it created resentment among the Muslim populations. And of course, you probably know about the jizya, do you? It was a special tax the Catholics paid, the Jews paid. It was a fee for protection, intended, as Maliki texts make clear, to remind them of their submission, a lot like the mafia exercised in Chicago in the 19th and early 20th century. Protection. Malikit's Mulwata declares that jizya is imposed on the people of the book to humble them. Therefore, jizya ought to be paid in a humiliating manner. It was a fee for protection, intended, as Maliki texts make clear, to remind them of their submission, a lot like the mafia exercised in Chicago in the 19th and early 20th century. Protection. The dhimmi was made to stand, and he would present the money, the jizya, to the Muslim collector, who would be sitting higher up on a sort of a throne. This Muslim bureaucrat would hold the dhimmi by the throat, telling him, "O dhimmi, enemy of Allah, pay the jizya that you owe us for the protection and tolerance we grant you." Other Muslims would imitate the collector, and pushing around the dhimmi, and any other dhimmis that had happened to accompany him. The Muslims found this very amusing, and they invited anybody who wanted to come to see the Catholic dhimmi, who was seized by the throat by the Muslim as he stood there being forced to hand over the protection tax. The dhimmi was humiliated and was called, "O dhimmi, enemy of Allah, pay the jizya that you owe us for the protection and tolerance that we grant you." This is part of the record that needs to be set straight, is it not? As part of the dhimmi system, a Muslim officer of protection, unquote, regulated all affairs relating to Catholics. Was it a gangster-like protection racket, pay protection or else, that was profitable for the Muslim rulers? Muhammad's father-in-law, companion, and second caliph, Umar, made clear that this was a profitable system of extortion. Dhimmis were even more productive for Muslims than slaves, and therefore should be kept protected as dhimmis rather than parceled out as slaves, precisely because Muslims could live off them much better. This is the opinion of Muhammad's father-in-law and companion. After citing the verses from Quran 9:29, "Fight against those who do not believe in God nor in the last day, who do not hold forbidden what God and his apostle have forbidden of those to whom a book has been given, until they pay the poll tax from their hand, they being humbled." So let's get an actual quote from Umar, the close companion of Muhammad and his father-in-law. Here's the quote. "Have you considered if we take them as slaves and share them out, what will be left for Muslims who come after us? By God, the Muslims would not find a man to talk to and profit from his labors. The Muslims of our day will eat from the work of these people as long as they live. And when we and they die, our sons will eat their sons forever, as long as they remain. For they are slaves to the people of the religion of Islam, as long as the religion of Islam shall prevail." So this was quite a brilliant and pioneering triumph of medieval Islamic rhetoric, that the word dhimmi, meaning beneficiary of the contract of protection, that is, a protected individual or beneficiary, was chosen to designate the helpless victim of a religiously based extortion scheme. It was a gangster-like protection racket. There were other strategies that the Muslims used to ensure their dominance over the Catholics and Jews. For example, a Muslim who raped a free Catholic woman must be lashed. A Catholic who raped a free Muslim woman must be killed. Whoever slandered a Muslim must be flogged. But whoever slandered a Catholic was not flogged. A Muslim was entitled to full compensation for injury and perhaps death, blood money, but a Catholic was entitled to only half. Where a Catholic was allowed to convert to Islam, a Muslim was forbidden under punishment of death to convert to a different faith, and that's true today. A Muslim must not be executed for the death of a Catholic unless the killing was treacherous. But a Catholic could be executed for the death of a Muslim, even if the killing was accidental. The testimony of Catholic men or women was not acceptable in any legal matter involving only Muslims. A Muslim could have a Catholic slave,
but a Catholic could not have a Muslim slave. A Muslim could have sex with a Catholic sexual slave, but a Catholic could not have sex with a Muslim sexual slave. A Muslim could use for ablution, for bathing, the water previously used by a Muslim man in a state of impurity, or even by a menstruating Muslim woman, but not water used by a Catholic, for that water would be polluted. A Catholic woman was not recommended as a wet nurse because she was polluted with pork and wine. There are plenty of other examples that can be cited. A lot of these examples go on and on. It's quite a list. For instance, a Muslim must not initiate the greeting when meeting a Catholic. A Muslim judge must not hire a Catholic as secretary. A Muslim must feed a poor Muslim, but he must not feed a poor Catholic. A Muslim had an obligation to free at some point, Muslim slaves, but not an obligation to free Catholic slaves. A Muslim man could marry a free Catholic woman. All this was not advisable, but a Catholic man could not marry or even make love with a Muslim woman. Free or not, the penalty for that was death. The children of Muslim men and Catholic women had to be raised as Muslims, a not too subtle instrument to further the decline of the Christian population and the growth of the Muslim one. The Muslim master of a Catholic slave man could marry him to a Catholic slave woman owned by a Muslim master. But if the woman converted to Islam, the Catholic slave man was forbidden to have sex with the now Muslim slave woman. A Muslim man could not marry Catholic slave women,
but could marry a Muslim slave woman.
I don't want to wear you out, but the list goes on and on and on. Muslims could celebrate their religion publicly, but Catholics could not hold processions on the street and must discreetly celebrate their mass within their churches and neighborhoods. In Cordoba, under the Umayyads, Catholics must not walk through Muslim cemeteries because their presence would pollute the Muslims' tombs. Any food that was touched by a Catholic was polluted. Any water, any garment, any utensil. As late as the 15th century, in Catholic-held territory, Muslim law told the Muslims who were under Catholic domination that, quote, water touched by an infidel, a wine drinker, a cat or dog, cannot be used for bathing. Do not adopt ways of speaking, manners or customs of the Catholics, nor their clothing. And what about the buildings, the mosques and churches? Well, new mosques could be freely built and old ones repaired. But Catholics could rarely build new churches, and only rarely were they allowed to repair the old ones, no matter how decrepit. And they never could do it without the Muslims' authorization. Mosques could stand proudly in Islamic cities, but Catholic churches must not challenge the mosques by opening to main thoroughfares. They became very humble little buildings hidden away. Mosques and other Muslim buildings could be as high as architecturally feasible, but no Catholic church could tower above Muslim buildings. Mosques could not be converted into churches, but very frequently Catholic churches were converted into mosques. That was allowed. Muslims would have the morning prayer and loudly proclaim their call to prayer, but Catholics could not even ring their church bells. Muslims could proselytize, but Catholics could not. Catholics could be placed under Muslim law if they wish, but Muslims were forbidden to do so. Catholics could not display crosses on themselves. Imagine that. Not even wear a cross around the neck. Catholics could not display crosses on the outside or on the top of their churches. And that's happening in China today. It's just in the news yesterday that all of the Catholic churches and Christian churches in China are having the crosses removed from their roofs and prominent display out front. The crosses are being removed and thrown away. Catholics could not display figurative art on the outside walls of their churches. That's not a surprise, is it? The Muslims being so anti-image, so much the iconoclasts. Catholics couldn't even wear Muslim-like clothes. They must wear distinctive signs. We know about the yellow badge the Jews must wear. Well, Catholics had it too. When a Muslim entered, the Catholic must stand up. And the list goes on. We see that the much-praised tolerance of Al-Andalus
Well, that's part of Islam's imperialist system of separation from and subordination of Catholics. Catholics could practice their religion, but only on Islam's terms. Islamic clerics and rulers remained effectively in control in matters of religion. And because religion informed everything, they remained effectively in control of everything. This system of protection, then, was in reality a system of exploitation and subjugation. All the onerous details of everyday practical differentiation and subordination followed from and reinforced general assumptions of Islam's religious and therefore political hegemony. Medieval Islamic conquest quite methodically began this process of submission. After Muslim forces had invaded a place, overcome the local military, and chosen a capital, they would pause in their forward advance to subjugate the defeated. All the various forms of differentiation and superiority, including the proliferation of mosques and the limitations on churches and Catholic public worship, fostered conversion and Islamization without any need to resort to forced conversion, while at the same time reinforcing the conqueror's power. This has been Setting the Record Straight.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.